Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And today on A Taste of the Past, we have a special event. I did a live recording at Industry City with Ed Levine. And at Industry City is a kind of a buzzing business and retail hub in Brooklyn. And we have, Heritage Radio has partnered to do a series of on-site recordings. And this one with Ed Levine was terrific. So I'm going to play that for you now. Ed Levine has recently located, he is the founder, the owner and founder of SeriousEats.com. And I'm sure most all of you know about SeriousEats.com. He has relocated their offices to Industry City, and they just opened a brand new test kitchen there in Industry City as well. He has also just written a book about founding SeriousEats.com called Serious Eater, and the following is our conversation about it. Today we're recording from Industry City in Brooklyn, and it's a very exciting place to be. A lot of new shops and working space and tons of buildings and a new set of offices as well as test kitchen has opened for SeriousEats.com. Now, I'm sure that at least three or four hands would go up to say, how many times have you been on the website Serious Eats this week? And I know I have. That's three. Okay. Serious Eats. And I'm here with the founder, Ed Levine. Ed is a kind of a man who wore, but now wears one hat, but wore many hats over the years.
That's true.
What do we call you? Yeah, we call you the founder.
Founder of Serious Eats, a food writer, podcaster.
Jazz musician or aficionado.
Actually, I booked a jazz club. I was a terrible jazz saxophone player. But I booked a jazz club, I produced records. I've never deviated from my nonlinear career path.
So food was always your passion?
Well, before that, jazz was.
Jazz. So. Jazz and food. Well, they go well together, I think.
Yeah.
But, and you, I mean, you were a TV, you still are a radio host, but you were did a TV stint
yeah,
as
I have
well.
A podcast, a series of a podcast called Special Sauce.
Right. But seriously, I mean, you are the founder of Serious Eats as well as the creator of Serious Eats. And you were inducted into the James Beard Foundation's Hoo-Hoo of Food and Beverage because Serious Eats was not your first venture.
Well, it was the first sort of full-fledged entrepreneurial venture. I always had lots of ideas. I was an almost entrepreneur many, many times, but this Serious Eats was the first time where, like, I raised money. I, you know, said I wasn't going to do anything else, and then I embarked on a 9-year adventure.
Well, you did the your New York Eats book, and then you had some New York Eats.
Yeah, that was 1991. That's when people thought you needed a visa or a passport to go to Brooklyn. So it was a sort of idiosyncratic guide to non-restaurant food in New York. And at the time, I was running an ad agency, and I sort of wrote the book in my spare time. I just go to a different neighborhood every weekend and write it up.
So while you're running an ad, while you're working in an ad agency, you're writing a book on food.
Yeah. And then I started writing for the Times and did a radio show on WNYC and did a television show on a regional cable network.
Right.
And so I sort of became a food media person.
Well, and you did so many articles in writing as a journalist for...
Sure.
For, I'm thinking, GQ, Business Week, The New York Times. And your stories were always a focus on iconic foods, and mostly iconic, iconic American foods.
Sure.
So you would do like a deep dive into hamburgers,
bagels, or cheesecake.
Yeah.
Mostly a lot of New York, iconic New York foods.
Yes.
I wrote a whole book on pizza called The Slice of Heaven. It was any food that I loved, I would just take a deep dive into. And that kind of deep dive became the basis for Serious Eats. Although when I started Serious Eats, I had no idea that it would become a go-to recipe and technique site.
So, you know, for the people who have not been on the site this week, and as I say, most of us, you know, refer to, for recipes and for... restaurant reviews, everything. Describe the site for us. I mean, it's really all-encompassing, right?
You know, I think it's the place where people go online when they want to sort of get the ultimately tested pasta bolognese or that's informed by craft and food science and lots of things that we bring to the party, the people that write those pieces, like Kenji Lopez Alt. He was the first recipe developer I hired at Serious Eats, and of course, he started the Food Lab as a column on Serious Eats, and then turned it into a best-selling book called Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science.
Right.
So that, until that point, and that sort of set the tone for the site, which was... You know, we're gonna test 40 ways to make chocolate chip cookies, and write about what we found with a sense of humor. So we take the subject matter seriously without taking ourselves too seriously, and that's still what we do today. No matter what we're writing about, we could be writing about hard-boiled eggs. We could be writing about pizza. We could be writing about smash burgers. Doesn't really matter. That was the business plan. It was like, have people nerd out on whatever it is they were writing about.
And anyone who has actually gone in to watch some of the videos, you say you don't take yourself too seriously. The videos are so friendly. They're so funny. And,
we try.
Stella Parks, ham it up a little bit and be a little funny. And Daniel Gritzer, all so great.
Yeah. They're all... a lot of them started as restaurant cooks, or in Stella's case, she was a pastry chef at restaurants. And so they bring a lot of craft, but they also, to their cooking, but they also bring writing craft. And again, they have the same values that I had when I started the site. You know, which is really important to me. So
well, now that Kenji Lopez Alt has gone on to his own things, I mean,
he's still an advisor to us, and he still contributes to us.
And Stella Parks as well.
Stella is on staff, and so it's really exciting to watch.
Well, when I thought of that, and then I read about that, and the wonderful people taking their places. I realize that I kind of likened Serious Eats to Chez Panisse, but of the internet.
Chez Panisse of digital food.
I take that
as a high compliment.
Chez Panisse was a springboard for so many great chefs to go on to their own thing, their own restaurants. And you're a springboard for so many of these food writers and developers to go on to their own thing.
Yeah, so it's great because someone referred to it as the Serious Eats diaspora.
Well,
the other
yeah.
day. And I like that
yes.
because nobody really ever leaves the Serious Eats family, even when they, like Kenji, you know, open a restaurant. You know, he's still involved because they all still care about what we do and about what they do for us. So that's a nice feeling for a founder.
Now, if a lot of you aren't, and some of you aren't familiar with the obsessiveness and detail of Kenji Lopez Alt, which he gets from the founder as well, I guess his most recent article was the first one that he did since leaving for the Food Lab, was about, as you mentioned, all those myriad ways to boil an egg. And what's
yeah.
the
well,
best way?
Well, he had done that for Serious Eats.
Oh, he had.
And
okay.
he started doing a monthly column for the Times. Although he is still working, you know, still doing stuff for us. He updated his boiled egg obsession, his hard-boiled egg obsession.
Well, you have always been, as we mentioned before, you wore many hats over the years. As most of us who ever started out in the food world of a particular age, we all wore many hats because there was no such thing as the Food Network or the food websites. There was no internet. There were no places for us to go. And food writing was just something people did when they didn't get assigned another job. And then of a certain age, things came along where it became a respected journalist venture.
My late mother-in-law actually was proud of what I did by the time I launched Serious Eats, you know.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's food writing is very different than it was. But, you know, for me, I started Serious Eats because, as a freelance writer, you have nothing but lots of gatekeepers in your life that you're always pitching your ideas to. So I didn't want to pitch my ideas anymore because I just wanted to do them. And so the web offered the opportunity to do that, and food blogs.
Yeah.
And so that's why I started Serious Eats, so I could write about everything I wanted to write about.
Yeah, well, it's a fabulous site and so encompassing. And now also, I mean, nice, too, that the money is rolling in finally. And that's always a problem, is where's the money, you know?
Well, I sold it in 2015 to people who are really good business people.
But not and not just blatant advertising, but there is a features on the website for machinery.
We could test cast iron pans or rice cookers.
Right.
You know, we bring the same obsessive approach
and
to that.
It's very helpful, I think, for people, particularly, you know, people starting out in food, to know there's so much out there and to find out what's the best thing I can buy.
Yeah,
there's
also so much food media out there.
Oh, unbelievable.
You know, it's like,
unbelievable.
Someone told me there, and it's not just food podcasts, there are a million podcasts now.
Yes. Actually, it's over a million now.
So it's hard to figure out where you can go for reliable information, and that's one of the things we pride ourselves on. It's like, if we test cast iron pans or rice cookers, you can trust what you find in the results. And, you know, whenever I'm eating out or I'm talking to chefs, I always, I'm really proud of the fact that that the best chefs, you know, you can find anywhere in the country, they all read Serious Eats because it's credible and they know that we do our
That's
homework
right.
and that we're not just tossing stuff off.
Right. And as I said, it wasn't your first venture, but of course the internet and webzines, what do you call it? Just a website, a web everything. It's just your all-in-one web
And it's also changing. You know, digital media is changing at the speed of light. So, and that's why I wanted to memorialize my experience in the book that you're
and well, that's holding. What I was just going to mention is that the whole trip, your whole journey, is written up in your memoir here, Serious Eater. And I first met and saw or knew of Ed, didn't really meet, but as I say, we were in the same room and probably walked with the same people walking by one another. And you came into the Food Network where I was working at the time. I have this vision of you. I think you were probably pushing the New York Eats book at that time, right?
And I still had red hair.
Oh, okay. That's right, you did.
Nobody believes that.
Mine who works has not
at
changed.
At Serious Eats anymore. I have to show them photos.
That's great.
But, I mean, at one point, actually, it's in the book, I was up for the job as president of the Food Network. But then I think it came down to me and somebody much more corporate.
I remember and, who that was.
It was just like, how could we hire this guy? That would really be risky. That was my experience in general in corporate life. So that was another reason I started Serious Eats. I wasn't a very good employee.
You weren't a corporate guy, huh?
No.
Yeah. I hear you.
I think I'm a good employer, but I was not a good employee.
Well, that brings me to the next point, because you said they didn't want to hire you, maybe because you were a little too confident, because you were too...
Well, I talk about in the book, I called the acting president after I found out he was negotiating with the other finalists. And I said, well, what happened, Jeff? And he said, well, you scared a lot of people in Providence. This is when the Providence Journal Bulletin people owned the site. And I said, well, why did I scare them? He said, you had so many ideas and you seemed so confident. I didn't know that was a bad thing. But I guess it is in corporate life.
Yeah, I guess they sort of figured, and we are hearing a lot of that in the upcoming election campaigns, too. I mean, you have a lot of ideas, but then they probably worry about, well, how much is it going to cost? How are you going to implement them? What's going to happen?
Yeah, and it would have been a terrible fit. I would not have lasted long.
But as an employer, I read your comments on putting together Serious Eats and who you hired and what was happening, and you didn't exactly look at resumes too deeply. What was it that you looked for?
Well, I would just talk to people and I would read stuff that they'd written, and you know, in the beginning I couldn't afford to hire any experienced people, really experienced editors or writers, so I would just hire the youngest, smartest people I could afford and just turn them loose on the world.
And, hey, they were all looking for a byline. I mean,
and
you know.
And it worked out for everybody. Right. And even Kenji, you know, because people weren't paying. It wasn't like, I think I was paying more than most other blogs. And I said in the book, I was paying Kenji $35 a story. And, you know, he had another job. And then he moved to New York and didn't have that job, and so he just started writing for us. And he once told me, he said, you know, I vowed when I left Cooks Illustrated that I would never have another boss again, and you were the closest thing I could find to not having
a boss.
So
that's good.
And it worked out for both of us. And in general, That's how I manage people. It's like if you're a self-starter, if you want to go deep and you have writing chops and you have cooking chops or you have both, then just go. You know, it's like that was sort of the entire business plan.
Well, you just mentioned something that's interesting, too, or if you have cooking chops. Now, that's interesting because you
never once mentioned anything about cooking. You don't
cook?
No,
I mean, I'm a good home cook,
you're
but
an eater.
I've never written a recipe. I'm a serious eater.
You're a serious eater.
You know, I'm not a, but I, you can recognize when somebody has a craft-oriented approach to cooking and writing, like Kenji or Daniel Gritzer or Stella Parks. You know, they what they all have in common is they have different versions of the Sirius East voice, which I used to describe as passionate, discerning, and inclusive. So they all know their stuff. They take what they do seriously, and they think nothing, just as I would taste 50 hamburgers before I wrote the hamburger story in the New York Times. You know, Stella's going to test 25 Oreo recipes, you know, or her version of an Oreo. Right. And I love that.
Yeah.
And she can write. And she's a really provocative thinker, and she has a great sense of humor. And so it's like, you know, there are people that have the whole package. They're hard to find, but...
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, and I don't even have to ask the question now, and I'll just repeat what you said. I mean, what is so wonderful is that you really encouraged their personal voice.
For sure.
To come through.
Yeah, because I had experienced, you know, when you're a freelance writer, your writing is turned into the sausage of whatever publication you're writing for. So
the voice of the paper.
Yeah, so, I mean, when I was writing for The Times, and I wrote for a lot of great editors there, Sam Sifton and Pete Wells were the editor of the section for a while, and they did let me, they'd encourage me to write in my own voice, but that was really unusual, you know, and it still was filtered through the Times sensibility. I mean, it's the Times, you know, so I understood that, but it... Over time, sort of that gets really old, and you long to write your own voice. So when I would hire people, I had that in my background. So how could I expect them to adhere to my sausage making? You know, I couldn't begin to tell Kenji Lopez Alt what to write about hard-boiled eggs, you know, or even how to write about them.
You've hired so many different people, you know, coming in to keep this going. I mean, I can't imagine how many people were stuffed in that little room you originally have, and now you have big offices here in Industry City.
Yes, it was a little room. It was Ferrara's old cannoli factory on Grant Street. That was our second office, with a totally jerry-rigged kitchen that the buildings department would have closed in about 2 seconds if they would have walked in. Mercifully, they never walked in.
I've only seen one picture taken in that room, and I don't know. There must have been 10 people standing.
There are 10 people.
I mean, 10 people barely fit in that room.
With an IKEA kitchen island, with an induction cooktop that Kenji found somewhere on the internet. And there were all these exposed wires. It was not pretty.
But they would take a beauty shot of a dish, and it would make your mouth water.
Yeah. Well, we had there was a photographer and food blogger named Robin Lee, who was our first visual director, only I didn't know how to call her a visual director, so I just hired her to be an editor, but she was a phenomenal photographer and also a great blogger. She had a blog called The Girl Who Ate Everything. Which I don't think she keeps up. She moved to Norway to marry a Norwegian postman. Or should I say postperson?
Postperson, postal worker.
And they both, right? They're both now post people. So Robin has become...
You don't know what she does in her spare time while she's running that ad agency, Ed.
And she lives in... they live in Bergen, Norway, which is pretty far north.
Beautiful, too. Beautiful place.
Very beautiful.
You've used this word a couple of times, and it comes through because it comes through and it came through in your book, and it comes through in all the writing that you've done over the years. I mean, Ed's the guy who's always walking around holding, like, the gooeyest piece of whatever it is you could be thinking, because he's tasting it, and he's He's letting you know whether it's good or not.
It's not a hard job, right?
Someone has to convey that information to the public.
When I was writing my pizza book and I would call home, my son, I think, was 10 or 11 at the time, and he said, "So how's the work going, Dad?" You know, because it's hard to imagine that tasting pizza all over the country and all over the world could be described as work.
Yeah, right. Tough life. Someone's got to do it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But you mentioned this word that I was talking about before in talking about the people you hired and how you chose them and what you wanted out of them. And that was something that you've always expressed in all your work, and that's passion.
Yeah.
Passion for food.
And humanity. You know, it's like, that's the common thread of anything I've ever done in my life. You know, it's like I've been really lucky to make my living through my passions and still upright to be the elder statesman of someone who makes their living through their passion, you know, and I don't take that responsibility lightly, you know, and I'm very grateful. Well, I also have a very understanding wife.
That's helpful. Yes.
Who's a very successful literary agent. So, but, you know, the book and the story of Sirius Eats would not be complete without mentioning her because you need a supportive partner when you embark on this insane adventure that I embarked upon, and I had one, so I was very lucky that way too.
Well, I'm sure what you don't think about every day and didn't think about every day while you were trying to cobble this together and make it work, and you stuck with it. You were one of those guys who was not going to lose. You were going to keep at it.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I once met with a banker and he was like, congratulations. This was in the middle of the struggle, right? And it was just like, congratulations on Sirius Eats. It's really great. And so I said, well, you know, I really like to win. And he said to me, you know, that's bull. Everybody likes to win. The people who drag their businesses across the finish line are the ones that refuse to lose. And I think it's a distinction with a difference.
Right.
You know, and yeah, I was in the refuse to lose camp, because I just couldn't imagine giving it up. You know, it's like, I, whenever I would think about it, I just like, that just can't happen. And I think that's what you need. It's not just in whether you're starting a food website or anything, right? Especially when you're perpetually undercapitalized, which we were.
Industry City is New York's hub for the innovation economy. A diverse mix of over 500 businesses call Industry City, or IC, home, collaborating across a 16-building campus, merging today's creative sectors like tech, content, creation, and design with craft making and traditional manufacturing, not to mention some pretty good food as well. The IC food scene is rich yet approachable international experience for every palate. With 5 acres of outdoor space, more than 50 experiential food vendors and retailers, plus unrivaled tenant amenities, Industry City is a bustling hub where 8,000 people come to work daily and thousands stop by for a visit.
So I was very fortunate. I found the right people and it came at a good time, and I was pretty determined.
You were. And, you know, one of the things that I was going to say that you weren't probably thinking about, but what a lot of young people going into the food world today have to appreciate, you've opened the doors for so many young people to find a way to use their voice, to get on the internet, to write.
But I hope that's true. You know, I mean, I'm really proud of the Sirius Eats diaspora, you know,
you should be.
And the book is really as much about all of them as it is about my life, you know, and it's about Kenji and Stella and Daniel and all the people that have come through the Sirius Eats doors, and they're permanently members of the Sirius Eats family, you know, and even when they leave to do their own thing or do something else, it's just like they always come back, which I'm really proud of, you know.
Well, in the book, you do include a lot of ups and downs and sad parts of your life, which we all have, you know, losing people. And and you lost your parents at a very young age. How do you feel that impacted your work ethic and striving to lose, not to lose?
I did lose my dad when I was 12 and then my mother when I was 15. And then I was raised by my older brother who became the first investor in Sirius Eats. So what a tangled web we weave.
Was he trying to get you out of the house, maybe?
But I think it affected me in a lot of ways. Number one, you know, it sort of reinforced a determination to move forward, right? Because, you know, what's the choice, right? You can either crawl up into the fetal position when bad stuff happens to you, or you just have to figure out a way to put one foot in front of the other.
That's right.
And you know, it was hard to write about that stuff in the book, but I felt it was important because, as you said, everyone deals with a lot of adversity in their lives. You know, I don't have a monopoly on that. But it also, you know, it allowed me to dream big, you know, because there was, you know, my brother would say, oh, you know, you're never going to be able to make a living doing whatever I said I was wanted to do. But it's different than when it's a parent, you know. And yeah. So it gave me, in a way, it gave me freedom to fail, you know, but it also made it hard because in the absence of my parents, I tried to make my business into a family, which has its own set of advantages and disadvantages.
Disadvantage, right.
So,
sure.
You know, I, like when people would leave Sirius Eats in the old days, I was devastated because it was like somebody was dying. You know, it was like I couldn't distinguish being disappointed and devastated,
yeah.
You know. And so, you know, and that I think that, too, was a result of the things that happened in my childhood. But, you know, as you said, nobody has a monopoly on that stuff.
That's right.
And the book, I hope the book is both a cautionary tale and inspiring.
A couple different things in it, in addition to that, those experiences. You ran a jazz club, you were an impresario for many musicians, you ran an ad agency that did incredible campaigns for names that we would all know, but your passion was always to get back to this food.
Yeah, and I would always... And even, you know, like the trouble with the ad agency was that when you're running an ad agency, especially somebody else's ad agency, you can't only take on clients you're passionate about. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Well, you know, and that reminds me of a story in the book that you told, and I'll let you tell it. It's you were writing some articles for the Times, for the food section, and they're always great. His articles would always be on the front page. You'd see this big slice of pizza or this bagel,
right.
You know. And someone left the writing post and you wanted to get hired to be on staff.
Yeah.
And Sam Sifton was hiring.
Sam Sifton,
and what did he tell you?
It was his first stint as editor of the section. He's now editor, the food editor for the whole paper. But so I heard he was looking to hire somebody, so I said, hey, you know, Sam, I'd love the gig, and let's go have lunch and talk about it. And And I said, so what do you think? And because I was, you know, was it, when you're a freelance writer, it's always feast or famine. You know, you either have too many assignments or you don't have enough.
Looking for the next job while you're doing your job.
Exactly. Right? So I said, so what do you think? You know, I can write. You know, I'm a good reporter, you know, and we work well together. And he goes, I'm not going to give you the job. So I said, why? He said, because you are not meant to work at a place like this. You know, it's like, if I gave you the job, I'd have to send you on assignments to fill space in the section that you weren't necessarily passionate about. And that's not what you should be doing.
Yeah.
And then he said, I know you're going to be really pissed at me, but you're going to thank me in the end. And it's
good read.
It turned out to be true.
Yeah, good read on you, for sure. You were passionate about your food, yes, and you were always in search, kind of your modus operandi was finding the best of.
That's what my first book became, which was a sort of irreverent guide to where to find the best of anything in New York, in the New York foodscape. And people would always say, how do you know what's the best? And I said, it's one of these I think, therefore I am kind of things. And you can read my stuff and go try the burgers and make your own determination. And more often than not, people would say, you know, I tried that burger and it was really great. Or I tried that slice of pizza. And that always made me feel really good, because not only was that did it reinforce my own beliefs, but it also gave the handmade food people an early avenue of being recognized.
Yes.
And, you know, now it's commonplace, you know, like Industry City is filled with artisanal crafts people and food makers and distillers and, you know, but... You know, you have to be as old as I am to remember that when I started doing that kind of writing in 1991, nobody was writing about that stuff. Nobody was writing about farmers. Nobody was writing about butchers. And they were so happy to talk to me, because finally someone was recognizing them for what they contributed to the culture, which was a lot and still is.
So beyond the best of... There was something behind that, and there was the story.
My dad was a, I was a, as I talk about in the book, I was a red diaper baby. Both my parents were communists in the 30s, when a lot of working class people, especially Jews in New York, were gravitating to the Communist Party, which obviously means something very different these days. And so... I inherited their missionary gene, you know. So, like, they, if you wanted to venture an opinion in my house, you had to bring your A game, you know. And so you had to be willing to stand up on a soapbox. And that's what I was doing for the burger makers or the butchers or the or the pizzaiolas or whatever. And that's just what I naturally do. I was doing it in music before I was doing it in food, only I was doing it for jazz musicians because I wanted them to get the recognition they deserve.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always been my MO.
You said that you, when you started reading the articles that the people you hired were writing, you were really impressed with them. And I think it was probably something Kenji had written, or maybe Sully. And you recognize the importance in not just finding the best, but in the storytelling.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that Serious Eats is, in the end, all about storytelling.
It is wonderful that
you know,
way.
Like any, I think any successful media entity is about the quality of the storytelling. Even in the New York Times, you know, and it's like, look, it's the greatest newspaper in the world, and it's filled with the smartest people. Someone once said, the New York Times is filled with the people that you always thought were the smartest people in your homeroom. You know, I think it's really true. But, you know, So, you know, that was always important to me. And you can tell just when you talk to people, you know, like if I would invite them out for coffee, in Kenji's case, we went out for burgers and tater tots, you know,
instead of
like,
coffee.
And you just know, you have, you know, you hone your instincts for like, this person has to write for Serious Eats. And we still do that even today, because we still use freelancers too.
You said in your book, and it's documented, for those who are out there trying to start, you know, putting ideas together, that you, the most important business lessons can't be learned without starting a business.
It's true. I wish it weren't true.
Yeah.
And I learned that it was true the hard way, because you just have no idea what's going to happen when you start a business. Even if you were well capitalized, you know, the world is full of good ideas that didn't work as businesses, and it's also full of bad ideas that somehow miraculously worked as businesses. But you just never know, you know. It's and I think the culture these days, we tend to glamorize startups, right? There's something very glamorous about saying, well, I'm doing a startup, you know, and it's not that it can't be exciting, but as a friend of mine said to me when I started Serious Eats, you are going to enjoy the highest of highs and tolerate the lowest of lows often in the same day when you start your own business. Mm. And it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, it was true so often. Like every time I was like Sisyphus, you know, it was like the boulder is just about at the top of the hill, you know, when we get a big ad buy. And then it was just like, no, it's not. And so you just have to keep going, because you never know what you're going to encounter. I say in the book, you know, when I started Serious Eats, I didn't regard Facebook as a competitor. I think the 2004, which was the first year they sold advertising, I think they sold a few $100,000 worth.
Hmm.
And when I, in 2014, when I started to put Serious Eats on the market, I think they were selling $15 billion. And that's in 10 years. You know, it's a crazy thing to contemplate.
Well, and in this sort of DIY method of starting Serious Eats, your business, you, as you say, sort of organically attracted your visitors, and over 8 million visitors a month.
Yeah. So
that's,
you know,
something
for
to
us,
be proud of.
Yeah. For us, it was, people would say, well, what's your SEO strategy? It's like, we tell the best stories we can, and we hope that people find it. I mean,
that's amazing.
You know, that's overly simplistic. We obviously obeyed the rules of search engine optimization, but it's almost impossible to keep up with that stuff, because they're based on Google algorithms that they don't reveal to you.
Huh.
And it's like a black box. And so you can use best practices, but it doesn't mean you always get the desired result.
Well, it attracted advertisers, attracted visitors.
It's true.
And became a success. And then, of course, you sold it, which is what happens. And
yeah.
What you look forward to doing.
And they moved to Industry City.
And moved to Industry City.
And so
right?
We have real kitchens that pass inspection. And we have a shooting
you
kitchen.
You can do films in.
And we have a test kitchen. And there's an amazing crew of people working here. And
so
it's really worked out. And, you know,
well,
now the space is almost too big. You know, we went from being really crowded into really an extended closet to this beautiful space with windows all over and a view of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. Well, you have succeeded. It is a success. And you told a very interesting story about a pizza maker became a friend of yours, Chris Bianco.
Chris Bianco,
yes.
Yeah.
And it was his one little thing story.
He's he told me when I was interviewing him for the pizza book, and I spent a few days with him in Phoenix, he said, I'm just trying to do one small thing right. And I think that's what we all can do. You know, it might become big, you know, and he said to me, pizza is the biggest thing in the world, you know, and in fact, Chris consulted with the Franks on a slice place right near Industry City in Carroll Gardens on Court Street.
That's right, they reopened, right.
And those slices are amazing because Chris always brings his A game, and the Frankies know what they're doing too. And Chad Robertson was this great bread baker from San Francisco in California, was also a consultant. So it was literally like a pizza super group, you know, and I brought pizza for the crew, Series Eats crew, the other week, and the slices are awesome. So.
See, it's back to pizza. No matter what he does,
it always comes
how
back
much
to
he
pizza.
Sees, it's always back to pizza.
There's even pizza in the title of the book.
Yeah, that's right. You did. A food lover's perilous quest for pizza and redemption. Would you say that Serious Eats is your one little thing?
Yeah, I do. And like Chris, to me, it's the biggest thing in the world. But yeah, I do think it was my one little thing. Well, and I couldn't be prouder of the work we do and the people that have that work there now and all the members of the extended Serious Eats family, you know, the Series Eats diaspora, as we
well. Congratulations to you, because through your perseverance and that drive and that passion, you did create a pretty marvelous thing. And as you said, who knows what's out there tomorrow?
Yes.
But for today, it's your one little thing, and you made it work.
Well, thanks.
You made it succeed.
Thank you
so much.
Saying that. Yeah.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.